Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. This is episode number 128, brought to you by two lovely sponsors, Environments for Humans, reporting their Front End Summit. That's frontendsummit.com. It's an online conference you can attend from anywhere in the world with a computer and a internet connection. That is coming up August 21st. So it's coming up really quick. Go check out frontendsummit.com. See who's speaking. It's all about the kind of stuff we talk about on Shop Talk Show. You're going to love it. And Adobe, welcome back. Adobe to sponsoring Shop Talk Show. Adobe does so much cool stuff for the web. We're going to tell you about some cool new stuff that's in projectparfait.adobe.com that I've been using lately, and some updates to Adobe Edge. And Dreamweaver is being all cool again lately. So let's kick things off.
Hello, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to the 128th episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design development with Dave Rupert and Chris Coyer. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Dave. This is a very special episode of the...
Why is it special?
Well, I guess it's not that special because it's our 34th time we've done this. It is a rapid-fire show. Stuff that we sometimes intro shows with. Instead, we're just going to jump right in and do as many questions as we possibly can from you, the listener. Oh my God, you're such wonderful people.
Thank you for your questions. First up is Warren Echetta writes in, I'm in the field of web development. I follow a lot of awesome people on Twitter. Paul Irish, Rebecca Murphy, Alex Sexton, David Walsh, etc.
Et cetera. Me too. Is my favorite.
By following these people, I'm constantly updated of new tools and cool stuff in web development. Backbone, Angular, Require, Ember, Jasmine, etc. Also my favorite. Now I'm creating a web application for a client because of the different tools, libraries, plugins, etc. that I'm aware of. I don't know anymore. When do I need to use those, or do I even need to use those, or how do I even implement it in a sane way? What's your advice on what I really need to do in order to become better? Do I really need to use those cool tools, or should I just stick with what I know for now and try to make it better? Should I unfollow these people in order not to pollute my mind with stuff I can't really use now?
Ooh. Yeah.
This is good.
I bet a lot of people relate to this, don't you think? That, like, I don't know. You hear about all these things all the time, so they ring a bell in your mind. You know, if somebody says Backbone, that's not the first time you've ever heard that. If somebody says Angular, you're like, oh yeah, the cool kids are all talking about that.
Yeah, no, I'm currently in this situation. All the JS Jabber guys who I like look up to, they're all talking about React. Oh, I'm putting React on my thing, and it's like from Facebook, and I'm using React, man, and it's great. And like, I'm just like, what is it? And I go to like to the website, and I'm like, this looks like garbage. I'm never gonna use this. So that I'm kind of like in that
Dave,
place. So
I'm so close-minded.
No. I don't want to be closed-minded. I think what I'm saying is, for me right now, like, and this is would kind of be my advice is if you go, like, you hear all these tools, right? And if you go to that website and you like don't understand what's going on there, that's probably not a tool for you right now. I think it's worth, I'm curious how you do it, Chris, but I think it's worth like getting a one sentencer about those things, so you know what they do. Like try to like put a little, I don't know, database field, a description field in your database.
Yeah, so that you can query for it later. Yes, that's that's an awesomely nerdy analogy to use. There's one thing that's it being on your radar, meaning that it rings a bell, meaning that you've heard someone talk about it before. It's another thing. It's a little bit better practice possibly to just do a little bit of research, do the 3 to 6 minute exploration of said website and read as much about it as you can, just at the highest level that you can, meaning that like you go and when you go to Angular, you don't just like read a couple of tweets about it, but you actually go to the Angular website and you read their like pitch for it, because all these things always have a little bit of a pitch, right? And try to get that to sync up with your brain a little bit. In Angular, I think that, you know, and I'm not always very great at this either, but I think the pitch is data binding, essentially. The pitch is like, there's things that can happen on your website, things that can be clicked and moved and toggled and typed into and selected and stuff, and that those things are attached to a data model. There's some kind of data that gets stored that is representation of those things that you've typed and clicked and toggled and stuff, and that you can use those elsewhere on the same page, but they're also attached to like a view which has a model, which has a controller or whatever that deals with syncing that data back to a database, a backend, a server type of situation if you need to, meaning that you're not like handwriting a bunch of AJAX calls and stuff. There's things in place to help you sync those two things up, meaning what happens in the browser and what happens in the database. And I don't even know if I have that all correct. You know, I'm sure there's ways to use Angular without a database and stuff like that. But I think that data binding idea is what Angular has to offer, and I've never reached for it yet. But I now kind of know a situation where I would reach for Angular, and that's above the step of it just being on my radar. Now I know like when I might reach for that tool. And I think you're not maybe in that space yet, is that you hear these words, but you don't know when you would reach for it necessarily. And I think it's a little funky because it's like, what do we tell you to do? Do we just say, ignore all that stuff, just keep doing what you're doing? That's not probably good advice, because you need to shake things up once in a while, you know? You need to kind of reinvent how you approach things. But at the same time, if you look at those things and they just don't seem like they're solving your client's problems, then it doesn't mean you have to reach for them.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm kind of a firm believer in like you grow into the tools you need. You know, you're not going to like just be like, "Oh, new client, of course I'm using Ember." You know, you have to be like, "Oh, we choose Ember because we, you know, that's actually got pretty tight parity with the Rails stack." You know, like
sure,
you can use it for other things, but ideally, it's a pretty linear thing, because it's got like Yehuda Katz and all those people who used to work on Rails now working on Ember. So it also, I guess, yeah, back to the head database, you just got to get some keywords going and kind of like. And then when you are changing your workflow, which you hinted at it, but I think we need to do that every year, every 2 years, you need to kind of shake up your tool chain and kind of deep dive into something that you really don't know about, I think. So
that sounds good. Good luck on your journey, Wern. We have another one here from Marcelo Alvarado. My question this week has to do with an emailer I recently received from Onnit Labs that included a countdown module timer inside the email using a GIF image. So let's say you open up your email and it says like, "React now! Big sale! Only 3 days left." Like, wouldn't that be cool? And then what was inside of it was like an animated graphic that had a countdown on it that said like how many, you know, minutes, hours, seconds, days, whatever you had left. It's just kind of like, it's, you know, it's like a gimmick. It's like a little marketing gimmick, but it's kind of an interesting one, right? He said, "I looked into it and it seems as though you can keep sending frames to an animated GIF using GIF sockets," which I guess I've never really heard of, but I can imagine what that means. "As a GIF image doesn't specify how many frames it has when it's loaded in the browser. So I guess you can just keep feeding it new graphics." Pretty clever. He found a GitHub repo and links it up. We'll put that in the show notes. I thought this was pretty interesting and a cool effect. Do you have any other insight on how this could be accomplished? It seems as though the one they're using can change via the date appended at the end of the URL. So it sounds like someone created a little server-side service to do this. And if you link up the source of a GIF, of an image tag to this and pass it a URL parameter of the date, it'll give you a GIF and it will start ticking down from that date, and it'll keep serving frames one by one as needed. Pretty.
Yeah, I think it's making an animated GIF on the fly that basically it gets the time that you got there, and then it starts generating how you do that. Interestingly, one of the recent episodes with Fabio, we were talking about email, like meta or email community groups or whatever, litmus/community. And on that, while recording that episode, I went to the community website, and the person I think who made this is on that forum. And I saw the thing. I can't find the thread now, but
I totally read it in there because I saw the same thing. Because it was one of like the top things at the time when we went to the forums during that Fabio episode.
I'm yeah, there it is. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was like, that's pretty clever.
Yeah. I mean, it totally can be done. And so it's pretty wild how they do it. I don't think I'd
have to dig into the code. I think that's what Marcelo is asking is like, okay, what's like the underlying technology here? And I don't, mm-hmm. you know, I don't really know, you know. It seems like it's possible. It seems like you have the same ideas that we have behind it, is that the server keeps throwing that. It has some kind of open connection is the idea, right? But I wonder mm-hmm. what the browser support for that is. Does it require the browser that it's being loaded into support WebSockets, or is it like deeper level than that? It doesn't matter because the browser just has to support animated GIFs and...
Yeah.
I don't know. Like,
well, it has to support like external GIFs, which would be the thing, right? Because some don't do that. You know, who Gmail will cache your images on their server so that they can sanitize them and do stuff like that.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know if it works
every
time.
But it won't,
time,
like, you don't necessarily, like, but maybe it won't because it doesn't end in .gif, you know? Like, the source is just a URL, and the URL happens to serve up the right content type, so it probably works. But I wonder if that's a way to get around Google's caching. Is that it doesn't like have a .gif at the end of it. I don't know, maybe. Yeah. And then like, does it just spin the browser thing forever because it never like gets like the final closing packet of data? Like, is that weird? Is that how it works?
Or? Yeah, I don't know. I think like it would have to calculate, you know, whatever kind of image magic-y app you're doing would have to basically calculate the number of frames from the current time which the email was opened and the time that the sale ends or whatever. It would have to calculate it could calculate down to the second the number of frames.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, that might be 100,000 frames. They're not going to send you 100,000 frames. I think that's the deal, is the thing, this thing works by sending one frame, then another one, then another one, then another one.
Yeah, so I wonder if it's just like kind of, I don't know. Is it? Yeah, it must just be like a GIF that never closes.
Yeah, right. Which is weird that browsers are cool with, but I guess they are. Anyway, maybe somebody in the comments can tell
us some tricks.
Yeah,
you could just like doop 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 5 seconds, goatsy. Boom.
or like you know, like an open webcam on my face when I send it out. You know, because it just, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, just me like looking judgingly at you while you read the email. Just
real time.
You did this. Yeah, just me getting angry. That would be most of my emails because I'm emailing. So anyhow, all right, hopefully we answered the question.
Yeah, I mentioned this at the top of the show. Go to frontendsummit.com. It will redirect you to the Environments for Humans site, which is all about this online web conference. It's coming up August 21st, and it's like an all-day thing, you know, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Time in the U.S. You can attend it from anywhere in the world that you have a computer and an internet connection, so no worrying about hotels and flights and all that stuff. Just come log in and listen to people speak live about all kinds of front-end topics. You're doing it, right, Dave? Are you on this list?
No, I'm going to be there.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be talking about tools, gulping, and
grunting. It's a funny week for that, isn't it? I mean, this is coming up in a couple weeks, but this week was like, enough with the tools already week. And I was like,
oh, was
more
it?
Tools.
Yeah, like,
yeah.
Well, exactly. Kind of back to the other dudes, the dudes, Wern, it could be a woman, but Wern's question, just like, what do I need to use? When do I do this? Why, you know, this is what this conference is for. It's just like, hey, let's take a look at how we do things and maybe try to do it better.
Yeah. It's tools is a big part of this. I mean, there's stuff about all kinds of stuff. But Ben Allman at the end is going to talk about the state of Grunt, which I think will be really interesting. I wonder, you know, if he's got like crazy stuff in store or if Grunt is feeling feature complete. I mean, I just have no idea what's going on in the world of Grunt, and I've been using it even more lately. I have a new site I'm working on that's in Jekyll, and it's using all kinds of crazy Grunt stuff. So I'm like, I'm all excited about it. I've always known all about Jekyll, you know, like, oh, I get it, you know, but now I have an excuse to work in a project on it. It's been super fun. So anyway, frontendsummit.com. It's $179. Use coupon code SHOPTALK for money off. Yeah, enjoy. You'll see Dave there.
Heyo. All right. Next question comes from Brian Stedman, and he's asking about Shodies. I am working with a site that generates its own short URLs, and I was wondering about adding link rel short URL, rel equals short URL, and then ref equals whatever, to my pages. First of all, what good does it do? Secondly, I also saw rel equals short link. What is the difference, if any, which should I be using? Christopher?
Okay.
Are you familiar? Like WordPress does this, right? By default, they give you like a wp.me URL or something. If you have it.
They do that. Yeah. But what?
If you do Jetpack or something.
Yeah. Good point. Like, because I think then, well, whatever, they run through the WordPress.com generator thingy, so it does need some kind of connection to WordPress.com to do it. I guess it wouldn't need to, but anyway, let's stick with the question at hand here, which is link rel equals short URL. One, it's weird that it's not a meta tag, right? But I guess the link attributes are kind of like meta tags. They don't actually do anything unless they have a rel that means something. And then one that we're used to is rel equals style sheet, which is how you link up CSS on a page. So this is just like adding a style sheet to your page, only the rel isn't style sheet. Thus, the browser doesn't know what it is. Thus, the browser probably won't do anything with it. Short URL is just kind of like meta information that's about your page. Short URL is the one that people liked for some reason. There was like a little like phase where people were like, this should be a thing because short URLs are a thing. And I want to list the like official short URL of this page as meta information on the page. I forget why exactly.
This is really Twitter inspired 2009, I think, is what I'm feeling. Anyway, right? Everyone bought their own like Latvian short URL domain things.
Yeah, and then so, they're like, if maybe Twitter can pick up on this URL that I'm programmatically putting on the page and use that instead of their own one or something, or like, this is basically meta information about this page, so it should be available in the HTML somewhere. Somebody wrote up a proposal for it. Short URL was the one that was favored, but I don't think it was ever standardized, and I don't think anything uses it. Then there's another one, which is link rel equals short link. And short, if you Google that one, that's the one that Micro Formats picked up. And this is what Micro Formats is all about, is providing meta information to describe a website, you know? So it's kind of like, that's the, like, short URL was kind of favored and had, like, support and stuff, but short link is the one, for whatever reason, that Micro Formats picked up. Neither of them do anything, and nobody cares anymore. Because, like, I don't know, we just stopped caring. I don't care. I don't know. Like,
yeah. It was a fad.
Should care.
You know,
go ahead.
Oh, there are some times where I think like short URLs are really awesome. Like a Book Apart puts them in their books. Like if they're, you know, like if they're trying to link you to some article, like, you know, yeah, historical article in the web, like they're like, rather than typing out adactio.com/2007/, you know, they're just like, go to A Book Apart /whatever/1, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, so that's like handy dandy.
That's a great case for it. And then because it's the whole point of it is it's easy to type with your hands. You know, we should be probably a little worried about short URLs that are subject to breaking. You know, like let's say you, like at some, like you can go to Twitter right now and export every tweet you've ever done. They have a really nice export feature. It gives you a zip file of all that stuff. Someday Twitter won't be cool anymore, and we're all going to download our archives, and we're going to put them up on our personal websites, and we're going to be like, that was a fun 8 years or whatever it is. And I don't want to lose all that content, so I'm just going to put my archive up here. I'm going to import it into my WordPress blog or whatever's cool at the time. And think of all those tweets. I mean, I look at everybody I follow on Twitter. I feel like I go to their profile and they have like 10,000 tweets and 80,000 tweets. I'm like, oh my God, we really poured a lot of content into this place. I don't want to lose that stuff. I just think it's interesting, you know, like it's a good stuff to keep and reference. Let's say 6 years from then, we go find this old tweet and it has some like tr.ln.8742. And you're like, oh, that cool link. That's just the tweet I was looking for. And you click it and it was a short URL to something that might still exist, but the short URL doesn't anymore. That's right. Gonna suck, you know? So we need to be a little careful about that. The whole reason that they were cool on the web was Twitter back in the day because of the character limit. And now they just use their own and they don't penalize you for posting long links. So like 99% of the reason for caring about short links is gone.
That's my humble opinion. But do you think we answered Brian's question? Just how do you do it? Regardless, or
just don't do it, Brian. It's useless.
Maybe don't. Yeah. Unless you got a good use case. I like them for throwaway URLs too. Like we do, sponsorships, and those are total throwaways, but, you know, like they'll give us some code and they're like, oh, by the way, you need a tracking ID in there. And we're like, oh, well, no one's going to add a query string to make us money. So we need, you know, we'll just make a bit.ly or something that has all that junk in it. And it's a really handy URL. Or people use it for links to their presentations, their slide decks. I find that to be handy. Yeah. But I don't know that everything.
Oh, sure. It's in a situation that's not the web. Anywhere you take a link, a URL, and you move it away from the web, it should be like, you know, the new QR code. That would be nice. Sure, you are. But I was curious. I looked into this at one point because I was like, what, like I'm looking at a tweet by Treehouse right now, and in Tweetbot, it doesn't show me the, you know, the t.co link or whatever. It tries to expand that and show me what the URL where I'm going to go when I click it. And they have Treehouse must have a short URL. It's trhou.se. So the question is like, did they post their own short link? So then what's happening is when you click this, it really actually goes to the t.co link, and then it goes to their short URL, and then it goes to where I need to do. So it's like a triple redirect to get where I need it to go. Or is it showing me their short URL because they have some link short URL on the page, and Tweetbot is honoring that somehow and putting it in here?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think so. I think it's just Treehouse must have their own, and they must have some internal reason for having it, because like that's their little app for tracking clicks or something.
Tracking their clicks, right. Yeah, their like social media fuel,
which you don't really need. Because
site I go.
Go ahead.
The site I go to, CodePen, has a CDPN.io.
Yeah, and I want to get rid of it. It's gone. Like we did it. I can't remember why. It was probably before Twitter was really doing this on their own. And I was like, they'll be more shareable. And I don't know why, but it's absolutely useless. And we need to get rid of it. In fact, we already have gotten rid of it from the UI. But like, we can't make them not work, because that's the whole point. So as soon as we got rid of it, we knew that we would have to support them until the end of time. So.
Yeah, no, it's kind of like a it's a feature that you now have to support for the rest of your life.
Yeah, you straight up, you know, and that's what I knew. I remember having this feeling so clearly when people were building their own short URL ones and using them and being like, I'm going to use my own instead of bit.ly. Bit.ly could go down, but my website won't never go down. And I was like, I freaking promise you that your little self version of this is going to go down before Bit.ly does. You know, people are all you, and whatever you think, you suck at keeping your own URLs up. Not everybody does. I'm sure some people take it very seriously, but by and large, as a people, we're very bad at keeping URLs around that we say we're going to.
Well, this is like the URL show. Another thing I hate is like when somebody, you know, it's like, Jessica Hish has really good. It's like jessicahish.is/thinkingaboutpizza or something. Mm-hmm. And then somebody's like, oh, I read this really cool Jessica Hish article. And then it's like myname.fart /TYZK. And it's like, now I don't know what you, I have zero context of the link you linked to on Twitter. And this is me, old man, complaining. But like, now I don't want to click it because you're like, awesome. And then you link to your like short URL. I'm just like, I don't know what that is. And why am I going to click it? Is it spam? Is it, what do I do? Is it really that interesting? But anyway, I need a drink. All right. Next question. Here we go. Dan Villegas writes in. What is your preference for dealing with layout for fixing design breakpoints in responsive designs? So, if I understand this question, he's asking like, how do you fix? Wait, so
were they broken? Is that the question, or is it? Do you mean?
Yeah, I guess were they broken or like setting the design the breakpoints? You want to take both questions? Let's see. If it's broken, here's what I do. I start small and I go out large and find where it breaks. Is that
sure?
That's the best way
right,
to
and
do
then
it.
adjust that number, and that's nice. And presumably, you can find the media query that has the number that isn't correct anymore and change it. That's why it's a little bit nice to have a mix in for it if you're using a preprocessor, because then you can change it once and all of them use it. It's not subject to you finding them properly.
And that's kind of your strategy for breakpointing, right?
Yeah.
Is these named breakpoints. Is that right?
Yeah, I like that. Although somebody went off on me yesterday about it. Like, you shouldn't handle media queries like that. That's dumb, because really you should write media queries like on a one-off basis based on when a component needs it. And I was like, oh, there's no such thing as element queries yet. I like them too. But then they're like, no, that's not what I mean. I mean, like,
like hyper to the content,
right,
rather than globe. See, I agree. I understand that point of view. I think it's interesting that somebody's like dev-splaining that to you, but it's also like if a user does resize and your layout just freaks out, like the less breakpoints, the better, in my opinion.
I mean, right.
Like minimum viable breakpoint. And if it looks a little bit weird on a Randroid device, like,
yeah,
then it looks
they
a little
have a good
weird,
point though. I mean, let's say you have like grids, but you have grids within grids too. So sometimes there's a grid within a grid and the parent grid is 50% wide, but later that grid is 75% wide. The point at which the internal grid needs to break is different. It's like a different screen width than the one that's in a wider area. So it's like the point is strong in that, like, just because like your base grid system breaks at these certain window points, well, the parent element that grid is inside may vary. So it's like, why aren't there element queries?
Dude, and that's the next thing the responsive images community group is working on.
Yeah.
Element queries. That's, because there's a lot. We've had Tab on, and Tab's a cool guy, but he's been the one, like, at least one vocal person, like, element queries can't really happen, or it could only happen in this sort of, you know.
He's not anti them, though. Those articles always end with, like, but we get it. You know, they would be cool. It's just
totally
complicated. And even Jonathan Neal has had some interesting points, too, that he's put a finger on what the specific challenges are, like infinite loops. So like, he's like, okay, right, Here's an infinite loop issue, and here's how theoretically that could be solved, you know?
Right. So yeah, I guess, yeah, I'm like so down to have them. I just want them. It's like, that's the next step. I don't think it's an engineering challenge, but that's exactly why Google has hundreds of developers working on Chrome.
And then in your world, you know, setting it is the same thing, right? Just, you know, squish it down and then expand it till it breaks, expand it till it breaks. Or if you're working the other way around, which I don't, I'm not dogmatic about which way your media query should go. squish it till it breaks, squish it till it breaks. I guess the problem with that is that, like, so many people are more comfortable working that way. And if you've never worked from small up, you should try it. So, like, but it doesn't mean that you absolutely have to do it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and yeah, you don't have to. I just, that's how I kind of see the world now. But yeah. All right. Well, hopefully, Dan, we answered your question. If we didn't, send it in again. yeah, but I hopefully that got you there. Next.
Yeah, well, let's do a sponsor. We have Adobe. Thank you, Adobe, for sponsoring Shop Talk Show. One of the tools that Adobe has been working on that I guess it says it's in beta, but it's like I've been playing it for a while. I guess it's out of alpha anyway. It's called Project Parfait, like Parfait, the dessert that ends with the T, like the French thing or whatever. Projectparfait.adobe.com. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. That's like it's like a single page web app that you like upload your own Photoshop document to. And it's supposed to exist in that world between like a designer that works in Photoshop a bunch and a developer that's trying to convert your PSD, which I know for a fact tons of people work in that world still. I'm doing that right now with somebody. So what's cool about this is that it opens that PSD in the web browser, and then you just click on stuff and it will put a little box around it and be like, oh, I see, that's a layer in this Photoshop document. It uses these font families. They're this color. It's this font size. It's this font weight. And it gives all you that stuff in CSS. So it's copy and paste. Pasteable as you need it, you know, which I imagine you'll mostly use this for reference, like, oh, what's that font family again? And you go grab it. It's smart enough to match those font families to stuff like Typekit. So if they designed this thing with fonts from Typekit, which is easy to do these days because Typekit fonts sync down to desktop now, so you could like design your whole website with the fonts in Typekit, and then your designer knows exactly what to put in the kit and which things to load and stuff like that. One of my favorite little features is I've been working so much with SVG lately is that you can, like, if they designed a shape layer as or designed like an icon or something and they convert it to a shape layer, which is like the vector thing that's part of Photoshop, you can click on that layer and then click the little arrow to download it, and then it'll give you all these options to download it, and it'll give you a perfectly cropped version of that as a JPEG, PNG, GIF, or SVG, which is nice. Even Photoshop can't really do that, you know, export to SVG from Photoshop or whatever. It's just a nice little thing. So if it's really nice for downloading assets and getting styles, gives you like gradients, it converts to the CSS syntax, gives you color palettes. It's just a really nice tool that exists in between the Photoshop to developer world. But, you know, also check out Adobe Edge Animate, which is like a timeline tool for dealing with CSS animations. I feel like a lot of those have kind of come and gone, and this is one that has stuck around. Dreamweaver's Live View is getting better and better. So anyway, thank you, Adobe, for sponsoring. Adobe does so much cool stuff for the web lately. Please keep doing that.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, can I give a shout out? I was messing around with CSS shapes the other day. You're familiar. Mm-hmm. It's kind of next level nerd stuff, but I was like, dude, like hand calculating the shape sucks. What can I do? And brackets, the like mm-hmm. open source Adobe editor, there's like a CSS shapes plugin there. Like, so you just like basically draw, like you whatever, move a shape around like a vector outline thing, and like it'll output the shape for you. Pretty nice.
Wow, as like this whatever weird syntax it is, like
yeah, cause polygon, it's like polygon. Yeah, 5095.
Yeah, that's what Adobe is good at, building tools to help us do the design things that we want to do. All right, Kyle F Folder asks, I'm in a bit of a bind. Not the jQuery kind, lol. I'm JavaScript. It's really JavaScript, but bind is the method in jQuery, certainly. When I'm developing sites.
Okay, here we go.
I'm developing sites that require social media integration, specifically thinking of Twitter here, I have been using Twitter.js, a library, to connect to Twitter's servers and pull in my feeds or tweets or whatever. This has been great, and I can fully customize the number of tweets, whether I want to show replies or not, etc., and more importantly, the full styling of those tweets. Now Twitter is cutting off their JavaScript engine to the public. So this is a little while ago. This is when they went, what was it, Twitter one API 1.1 or something like that, when they're like, okay, no more just like a totally open APIs to this stuff.
Nothing works.
Lots of stuff works. Yeah. It's just you got to OAuth to get it. And OAuth is not a full client-side thing. There needs to be some server-side component, right? Or am I wrong about that?
No, you're right.
It seemed...
Well, you could, but then you'd give some away, like a token to your
account. I see.
And then people would...
So it seems like Kyle's in a weird position here. Right. Is that a lot of people are out. There's not as many WordPress sites out there that just have my latest tweet in the footer or whatever, because like they just don't have super open APIs to do that anymore. And even if you could, they're a lot more strict these days about how you need to style and display that thing.
So you don't like we can't easily do JavaScript widgets like we used to, like to pull content from people. Thankfully, I don't know what you're on. Like, this is really just like three lines of PHP if you're interested in that. But if you're running like a static site generator or something like that, it doesn't work.
And you really should cache it, because otherwise you're hammering them and they'll probably cut you off. If it's like every single page view OAuths and pulls the latest tweet, that's a little irresponsible development-wise.
Yeah. If you got on Hacker News, it would just quit showing up. I mean, and then you'd have a big white...
Or worse, your PHP website never resolves and the page doesn't load, you know?
Yeah. I think like it's going to take some server-side stuff. I know there's libraries out there that can help you, so... it might be worth leveling up if this is a necessary feature. Again, like, is showing your Twitter stream on a site versus like just bouncing them out to Twitter super necessary? That's something for you to think about. But you know, if you need it, you can do it server side. The other thing you can do is, I mean, they offer the Twitter's widget, you know, which is going to look and styled exactly like they want it.
But it will have more functionality too. It will allow easier retweeting. It will allow easier following. It will, show up the URL, and you get a bunch of cool features, which is nice. But those do come at a weight too. You know, like just embedding one tweet has some pretty significant performance issues to it. You know, I usually find it worth it. I like embedded tweets. They're kind of nice. You know, although and there's their widgets are generally pretty nice. You know, I don't think I would throw it on CSS Tricks just because it's a little too important that way, but I might throw it on my personal website, you know. But more likely I would just throw follow guy, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing too, is like if you think mobile first, again, like, you know, if you're thinking mobile first, it's like a link to Twitter is way better, because then they can get to their Twitter app a little easier, you know, versus whatever kind of, like, rather than scrolling through an iframe on your site or whatever.
Just to be comprehensive here, there is a pen out there on CodePen that somehow gets around this latest tweet or something. If I can find it, I'll link it up. It's a very popular pen. Maybe I just found it here. The Twitter post fetcher. Yeah, here it is. I don't know how it does it. It's a whole bunch of JavaScript. It probably does something that Twitter doesn't want you to do, but this has been around a long time and they've never stopped it. So there is some way you can do this. I'll put a link to it with pure JavaScript. And the pen is very popular because there's tons of people like you, Kyle, out there that are trying to get around this and want to do it. But also ask yourself why. You know, it was such a trend for a while. I would look and be like, oh, nice latest tweet. Cool hashtag, bro. You know, like, if you like seeing someone's latest tweet, it's like, I know how to use Twitter. I prefer to just look at it in the context of Twitter reason. Just your latest tweet probably is pretty boring.
It's interesting they minified all the code to put into here. Oh, maybe Jason May's Twitter.
Yeah, but there's
API.
A GitHub link, so just go to that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, interesting. I'm curious now. I wonder how it works. I'm going to open the files and look around. There's like, I think that he's just going to the
Could
URL.
Be a scraper.
cdn.syndication.twimg.com/widget/timelines.
Oh, it uses the widget, their own widget against them or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is smart. Yeah. It's based, but if they ever change that URL, right. Womp womp, and then you have to go find it again. But anyway, that's Twitter. Great. That's cool. Jason Mays solving problems.
Let's skip the drama there because that's some old drama.
Old drama. Oh, shoot. Chuck emailed. We have an audio question, but I forgot to pull it up. But let's do one from William Luce. Writes in, I understand wanting to write in languages that every browser supports, HTML, CSS, but I can't figure out why we shy away from JavaScript so much. Mm. Is it about JS being turned off for a lot of users, or is it that it's difficult to write or something else? So, man, Chris, we've stumbled into some progressive enhancements.
Yeah, I just think, William, you live in a bubble like we all do. Like, for whatever reason, that in whatever world you live in, you think people are shying away from JavaScript, or you're shying away from JavaScript so that you think that's representative of everywhere else. There's certainly people out there that think the exact opposite, that we are absolutely not shying away from JavaScript. In fact, we are bathing in JavaScript these days, and JavaScript is absolutely everywhere, and perhaps we're a little too reliant on JavaScript. So I wonder what it is that makes you think that people are shying away from JavaScript, or I wonder if, like, maybe it's like not being taught as much as you think it should be, or if you think that people who are learning the web these days learn them, you know, some HTML and JavaScript, or HTML and CSS and maybe like a CMS or something, but don't dig into the JavaScript as much as you think they should be, or what do you think the subtext is here, Dave?
My gut is, you know, I instantly read the like performance enhancement sort of stuff, like, you know, why do people say we can't rely on JavaScript? You know, I mean, there's a few reasons, like, you know, network connection and stuff. And, you know, let's say one line of your third party JavaScript bombed out, that actually bombs out all the JavaScript on your page, that sort of thing, you know. So you could in effect kind of like stop the functionality of your page. Your page is useless. It just shows like just weird widgets and buttons that don't ever do anything. So I think that's like why people kind of don't canonize it. I like to think, like, if you do say, you know, JavaScript is actually as reliable as CSS, you know, then, like, wow, we have a whole world of things. We have templating access on the client side. We have, you know, we can AJAX in and guarantee that things AJAX in and stuff like that. Although there's more server response stuff, but I don't know. I feel like HTML, CSS, and JavaScript are the core tenets of web design, at least for right now and probably for a long time. Like, anything we do will have those three things in them in some form or fashion. So I think it's necessary to learn. I don't see if people like shy away from it, you know, it might be they're not programmers, you know, they're more design minded, which HTML or the web caters to. And that's, you know, ultimately it's a publishing platform, you know, but it's not. But then at the same time, it's also this what are hipsters calling it? Like a runtime. It's a runtime, right? So it is like an operating system at the same time. If you include JavaScript in the canon of what can be delivered, so I think the whole thing is like you're guaranteed HTML, CSS is super likely and so fault tolerant if it doesn't understand something, it will just quit working or it'll bail out on that. But JavaScript is pretty picky because it's a language, like it's like a functional language. So if you made a typo, it just stops totally. So that's the thing. Like CSS is graceful. JavaScript is, I quit working. So does that make, did I
think we hit it from a lot of different angles. We did a good job.
Okay. All right. That was a mouth gun because I have an audio question. Nice. I'm Chuck Dow. Our favorite kind of question here on the Shop Talk Show, and honestly, we've not been getting enough. So thank you, Chuck, for sending this in. Here we go.
Hello, Shop Talk Show. A while back on a podcast, you were discussing that it was a ways off before a retina-ready iBook would be available that had a touchscreen. The question had been dealing with touch events, and the conclusion had been deal with them in smaller breakpoints, mostly for tablets and phones. Well, with the new Google Chromebook being touch and the newer Windows 8 machines that can remove their faces to become a tablet, how do you deal with web design now? Not knowing when someone will want to touch my content on any size screen. Already frustrated with standard touch event handlers, this just seems like a lot. Any help would be appreciated.
Oh, Chuck has a good question. Digging up an old episode where we were totally wrong on something. Chris?
Yeah. What are your thoughts? Gosh, I was trying to find like the new cool hipster way to answer to this. Isn't it, have you heard this, Dave, where you should just assume, like work under the assumption that every browser has touch?
Yeah, actually, my coworker Trent Walton wrote about this on his device agnostic post. So I'm very much in this camp. I mean, like I have this chart. It's actually on CodePen, but input methods by operating system or whatever, and Macs are the only ones that don't have touch on laptop or desktop, and that just happens to be the only operating system most of us hipster web designers use is Mac. So we're like, so we don't think about it because our computers don't do that. But every other thing does that. Chromebooks, Windows 8, everything does touch. So it's this interesting situation.
What are some examples of something that you would do specifically for a touch device and not include on a device that didn't have touch?
I have an example. Very recently, did a website, and it has a thin little utility menu, you know, like where you stash all those dumb links, like in a top stripe way up top, you know, that like folds into a hamburger or something. And but that tap area is not big enough for like on a Windows 8 touchscreen. So like you touch it, and like you kind of hit everything else around it, and you don't.
It's too small.
It's really hard to. Yeah, it's like really hard to use, and it becomes a UX problem. So tap area, target areas is like a main thing. Like everything needs to be touch friendly, you know.
So is the solution to just make it bigger, or were you saying that I only want to make it bigger if I absolutely have to? So I want to know if I'm on a touch thing or not.
I mean, you could do that. You could do that. You know, you could like, it's like, I only want to make it bigger if I have to, but detecting touch is super hard. You can like do like, does touch happen, but there's some false positives. And you can't really detect touch until after, the touch device has rendered, you know, like your CSS.
So I've heard some other ones that are like, well, but let's say you detect a mouse move, then in the past you'd be like, okay, well, that must not be a touch device because it has a mouse. And Chuck's thing here is like, well, even that's not cool anymore either because a lot of things can have both. So we really need to
Windows 8 does.
Yeah,
both.
We need to identify in which case, where are we doing if modernizer.touch or if window.untouch start? You know, like, where are we doing that and why are we doing that? And can we just remove that logic and just put the touch handler stuff in there too? Like, how much extra code are we talking here? Is there situations where there's, you know, 100K of touch specific stuff that you're so nervous about loading on the desktop? I just don't think so. You know, I think these are little micro optimizations, and like just binding stuff to touch should just be assumed, and you should probably for the most part just roll with that.
That's what I think. I think we just need to assume everything's a touch, you know, and you know, your click handlers and even hover and stuff work on touch for the most part. Windows 8 has this weird thing. They use their own pointer event system to deal with not only touch, but they sell their little services with a stylus too. So it's got touch, stylus, and all these things. Anyway.
Isn't there, I think there's a filament, because a lot of the things are, well, what if I want to open a menu when it's clicked, right? And then I bind a click handler, but then do I also bind like a touch handler?
No, you just need to click,
right? And so. I think there's even like a filament group library that kind of, but like
tap.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what it does, because doesn't touch just bind to click also, but like it must deal with some.
Yeah. There's also these like event stacks, you know, like it'll fire. Does it fire the tap first or the click first?
And if you use Tappy, you can just bind to the Tappy API and it will handle that.
Yeah. Yeah. You just say this.tap or whatever on tap or something. So that's something to think about. Hammer.js is also really good for this. Hammer.js is interesting because it adds like swipe left, swipe right, and stuff like that, which is cool. I would just assume touch. I mean, I know like Gruber and all those guys are like, oh, because Steve Jobs said it. No, Mac will never have a touch screen on their desktop or whatever. But it's like every year it gets a little more like iOS. So I wouldn't hold your breath on that never happening, you know?
Yeah. I wonder how it will, because it does seem like I'd never want it. But I don't know. But I, you know, who knows?
Dude, so there's been studies or whatever, and hopefully I'm not quoting Jacob Nielsen, but there's been studies that like when people get a touchscreen laptop, at first they're like weird, but then you like quickly assimilate into that knowledge. And like you have that story about where your mom tried to tap the TV, right? Do you remember this? I quote it in talks all the time.
Oh, good.
You tweeted about how your mom tried to swipe the television, even though like
that when
has
about
a television
right.
ever been swipeable? Well, I mean, last night, my wife, like we have an Xbox, right? We use that as our media center. And like, she tried to touch one of the squares on the Xbox to like, just like make it do something. And I'm just like, did you just try to tap the TV? And she goes, no. And it was just like, I mean, it's just like, it's becoming our brains I mean, my son, dude, everything, any computer he's interacted with thus far has a touch screen,
right,
as far as he's concerned. I mean,
so it's probably going to happen. Like, what we need is fingerprint, is like gross proof screens. Because I don't really care on my phone.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
We'll see.
Right. Like self squeegeeing. Yeah. like a squeegee goes down at every hour.
That's an awesomely analog solution to that. I hope.
That's going to be that might be my first like node bot, is like just a little robot that like is a window cleaner for your screen.
I love it.
Kickstart it, make $1 million. All right. Hopefully we answered your question.
Nano drones.
Just everything's touch until you're notified otherwise. How's that sound?
All Let's right. finish Next up with question. This one by Corey Bateman, who asks, I have a question about CSS grids and mobile-first web design. I've made a grid that starts all the columns at 100%. Then the media queries use the percentages to accordingly to my column classes I've defined in a comment. I do this for each page based on the content breaking down and progressive enhancements. Many other mobile-first grid frameworks I see use a predefined breakpoints. Doesn't this go against the common rule of designing for the content and not the device? I feel like I have more control this way, but it seems to go against other grids and frameworks I've seen. Should I have commonly defined breakpoints, then tweak each page accordingly? So what I'm interested, I'd be interesting to see is code, because, I mean, yes, that does make sense. First of all, it's mobile first, which cool, you know, that's if that's working for you, rock and roll. But grid frameworks often have things like grid 1/4, grid 1/3, you know, grid 1/4 or whatever, so that you can use those because that's what you want. You're trying to get a quarter grid, so you get a quarter grid, you know? And if you're saying that you didn't put those in there because you add them later based on the content, it's not really a framework then, right? I mean, that's great, but it's like, then there's nothing to share with the world then there, really. It's just like dot sidebar with equals 25%. It's kind of like you're not using a framework at all, kind of, right?
Yeah. So There are people who are super like strongly opinionated on this, and I've pressed them about it and stuff like that. But people who are like Scott Kellum of Singularity and Snugug, who did like pointnorth.io, which is like an awesome thing. But they like talk about grids like they need to be designed for the content. And that's where like Singularity, Suzy, Gridset, stuff like that really help you kind of do that. It's like super specific based on the content. I like made ask for a change in their language to like acknowledge things like Bootstrap and Zurb and stuff like that. Like these 12 column grids that are predefined, but it's a generic way of flowing content. So that's where, if you use a generic system, that's where you're going to get every responsive website looks the same. It's because, well, you used a generic grid system, right? My problems with the like generic ones is usually they're just like, oh, it's a single column till 800, and then we do like 100 columns or whatever. Like it's like, yeah, you know, a 12 column system. You know, it's a one column until 800 pixels, and then everything flips out. That's my only issue with them. You know, otherwise it's just kind of like, I'm mostly like whatever gets the job done. You know, if it's a little bit, if you want, I say start with a really generic one and then building custom bits as you need them. I mean, if you need something with a five column deal, then do that, you know, build that your own. It's just a bunch of percentages, right? It's
right,
not that hard.
Right. Fluxbox is making it a lot easier too. I love it more and more every time I play with it because it's so easy to adjust columns and stuff like that. I wonder if the framework could be all a bunch of extends in SAS. That way you're not dictating class names and you can just extend a non-semantic thing like grid one quarter on a semantic element with a descriptive class name. I don't know. Whatever. If it works for you, yeah, cool. Show us a demo. You know, make a code pen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I think this is me. Like, I kind of want to see like A/B tests or something like show me content that's on a generic grid, and then show me what you would do to make it better, like quantifiably better, like. Don't just tell me like because it looks like my PSD now, so it's better. Like you have to like tell me why it's better. You know, like what was not fitting in the previous one, and what are your criticisms, and then what was what's so awesome about this new custom thing? Yeah. You know, does that make sense? I'm being a curmudgeon, but. But don't claim something and not back it up with examples or data. Shaboom. I'm going to end on that with a gunshot mic drop. Chris, I think we're done for today. I wish we had like a swan song sound effect, but we do have this one. We're done for today, but we'll be back with another episode in a weekish or so. We really appreciate you guys listening. Appreciate you following us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Be sure to tell your friends, rate it up in your podcatcher of choice. Check out Overcast FM from Marco Arnett. Marco at Marco on Twitter, because it's a pretty good app. If you're listening to podcasts,
I gotta try it out. Like I have a couple different ones, but I haven't tried it yet.
It's got this new. It kills dead space if you pay for the upgrade. So if we like pause for 10 minutes, it would just kill that space.
Does that
automatically
happen a lot?
Some podcasts are a lot slower than us. We talk pretty fast, so I think I'm curious what people listen to us at, if they do 2x or what or not, because I think we talk.
I bet that
fast,
happens in Gruber. You know, in the talk show, I feel like Gruber is a little bit like just like let's
a little drone.
I really like his podcast, but there is like moments of nothing.
Right. Just now that I think about it. So I think that is, so he cuts that out, and then it has this voice equalizer booster. So you hit the voice thing and you can listen to it in your car. It's cool. I just gave them like a free advertisement, but I'm like from a podcast listener to podcast listener, it's been a pretty cool life upgrade.
Yeah.
So
God, I found a podcast the other day too that I think that you always wanted to exist. I subscribed to it. Where is it? I know this is, we're trying to end this thing, but it was called Podcast Junkies, where they just talk about other podcasts. That's pretty interesting. Didn't you say that you wanted that at one day?
Yeah, no, I would love to do something like that. Is it? So if it's a podcast that talks about podcasts, I'm interested.
It is, but I haven't actually listened to it yet, so I can't officially endorse it. But and it doesn't, now that I'm looking at the titles of the shows, it doesn't, it seems like maybe they just have other podcasters on. It's not like This Week in Things that were interesting that we listen to in podcasts. But that still could exist, people.
Yeah.
Anyway, maybe we should just do this. ShopTalkShow.com.